When talking about sailing in Canada, there's far too much history to cover to keep it brief. You could spend hours just talking about Joshua Slocum. He was born in Nova Scotia in 1844. He was the fifth in the family of 11 children. Tired of the chaos at home, he ran away at age 14 and joined a fishing schooner as a cabin boy and eventually turned it into a full-time career on the seas. Before he was 20 years old, he had sailed to Indonesia, the Philippines, Hong Kong, Vietnam. He had rounded the tip of South America at Cape Horn twice. He met his wife in Sydney, Australia, and then moved to San Francisco. And it's after that where his story gets interesting. In 1895, he set out from Boston and decided to sail around the world by himself. More than 3 years and 46,000 miles later, that's about 74,000 kilometers, he and his 36-foot sloop named Spray landed back in New England, where basically nobody noticed because everybody was distracted by the Spanish-American War. But it was, in fact, a big deal. He was the first person to ever sail around the world solo. He later wrote a book about his voyage, which was a big hit, and made him at least a little bit famous. That's the short version, and that's just one very small part of Canadian sailing history. We have so much coastline in this country that life on the water has always been a part of Canadian history, economy, and culture. Our country was discovered by sailors, fed by fishermen who sailed on the oceans and the Great Lakes. Heck, we even had pirates, or privateers, or both, you know, depending on how you look at things. If you ever wondered how important sailing is to this country, reach into your coin dish and pull out a dime. The Blue Nose was such an iconic sailing vessel, technically a gaff-rigged schooner, that we put it right on our money. It's on there with the beaver and the caribou. Canada also has a pretty good Olympic sailing history. We've won 9 medals, the first one coming in 1932 in Los Angeles, and the most recent coming in Athens back in 2004. On episode 3 of See Thee Rise, we talked to Sarah Douglas, a 2-time Olympic sailor. This summer in Paris, she finished 8th out of 43 competitors in the one-person dinghy event. Some people call that the laser radial, and if that's at all confusing, well, just have a listen. Sarah explains it all. Let's get to it. On the show today, we've got 2-time Olympian, Pan Am gold medalist and silver medalist, Sarah Douglas, in the sport of sailing. Welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So, my first question is just semantics, and I'm going to ask some stupid questions, I promise. Is there a difference, or what is the difference between laser radial and dinghy?
No. And first of all, there's no such thing as dumb questions in the sport of sailing. I feel like we're always explaining certain things, but so essentially, the woman's dinghy is the laser radial, and it's actually, even to complicate it more, has gone through a name change, so it's also known as the Ilka 6.
Okay, so that's a little confusing, because in preparation for this, I was reading through Wikipedia and your, you know, competition history, and those seem to be used rather interchangeably. It's not an important detail, but I was just a little bit curious. But they're essentially the same thing?
They are the same thing. So the women's dinghy class is the laser radial, now known as the Ilka 6. So the men's dinghy would be the laser standard and Ilka 7. Mixed dinghy would be the 470 mixed class. It's just, I guess, the discipline and then the class, the type of boat that they're using.
Is it a different size of boat for the men and women? Is that the difference?
Different sail.
Okay. Okay. Well, again, that was more just my curiosity because it was bugging me, but now sheds a little bit of light on it. I want to start where the obvious start is, the Olympics this year. Paris just got done a little over a month ago. You've had a month to reflect and decompress. And so just looking back now, what are your thoughts coming out of those games?
Yeah, I mean, Paris was an amazing games experience for me. It was more of a normal games experience. You know, Tokyo with COVID and the restrictions and everything was a real challenge. And Paris, I kind of got everything that I wanted. Not an Olympic medal in the end. That I think my results was a bit disappointing, but in terms of an Olympic experience and, you know, something that you dream of, it certainly hit, and Paris did an amazing job with that.
Yeah, I was watching from home, obviously, just the venues, the scenery, the spectacle that they put on was pretty impressive, and it looked like just an amazing show, and I can't imagine having been part of it and also having to compete at the same time.
Yeah, I got to go to Paris at the end. So for sailing, we're a satellite village, and we were actually in the south of France in Marseille. So, I mean, a little bit of good and bad with that, in that, you know, you're kind of isolated and you get to focus only on your competition. And then afterwards, I got to go to the city and watch the other sports and see the iconic venues with the Eiffel Tower behind the beach volleyball. You know, I went to athletics. I got to go to canoe sprint and see the other athletes that I've come to know over the last couple of years compete and cheer them on was really cool as well.
What sports were you able to go watch?
Beach volleyball. I was supposed to go to the women's, but my competition got delayed another day, so I missed the Brandy and Melissa play. But I watched the men bronze and gold medal match. I got to go to canoe sprint, where Katie Vinson picked up her first medal, bronze medal there. And then I was there for athletics when the 4x100 meter relay team won gold, and that was such a cool experience. I couldn't believe my eyes.
Yeah, that was quite a run, and they definitely weren't, you know, kind of considered in that group of favorites, but they put quite a race together. Hey, I have been fortunate to be at one Olympics and two Paralympics, so just getting out to other venues and seeing what you're going on there. I got to go to a couple of Team Canada hockey games in Sochi. Seen sledge hockey in Korea, and then the other one we did was Beijing, but basically everything was on lockdown, so it was more like your Tokyo Olympics, where you just, there was nowhere to go and you couldn't see anything. So you talked briefly about your results, how it was a bit disappointing. You finished eighth overall, and obviously Everybody wants a medal. How satisfied or upset were you with that eighth place finish?
Yeah, I think I just didn't quite have it that week. Marseille, you know, for sailing, we compete over 6 days and we get different conditions every day. We struggle to get good or like strong wind for the most part. So we had a lot of postponements and delays, and I just didn't quite, I always found myself in the mix, like always in the pack. I never quite could break out. And I think for me to have, to be more in the mix for a medal, I would have had to kind of have those top five finishes that I just was kind of lacking that week. I think it was a bit of, you know, some of my strategy, my downwind speed lacked a little bit. I didn't quite take enough risk. I think I was a little bit too conservative with my racing. And in the end, I managed to kind of claw my way back into that 10th place position going into our finals or medal race. And so from there, I had a completely different mindset and outlook compared to Tokyo. Tokyo, I was in that fourth position, you know, where a medal was very much in the mix. And going into Paris in 10th position, you know, I just was like, you know, there's nothing to lose here. It's mathematically, I didn't have a shot at an Olympic medal, but I'm just going to go have a really fun race, a really fun day. And one of my training partners and closest friends was in that medal position. She was in the bronze medal position. So I think coming out of Paris, moving up to eighth place in that race and just having the best time and really taking that experience was great. And I actually came away from Paris in a more positive way and really happy with pushing all the way to the end and continuing to climb every day. And then having my training partner and one of my closest friends win a bronze medal was kind of the cherry on top for me.
So just break it down, the format. You have to race sometimes twice a day for 5-6 days in a row. You're supposed to do 10 races. Is that right?
Yeah. So we do an opening series. It's 10 races scheduled. So we do 2 races a day. Each race takes about 45 minutes to an hour. Obviously with wind and we're, you know, at liberty to the wind, we don't always get 2 races in a day. And so sometimes we'll get pushed for 3. We actually in Paris didn't get all of our scheduled races in, so we finished with 9. And from there, after the opening series, the top 10 boats from the standings move on to what we call medal races, essentially a finals. It's half the time, it's only 20 minutes, and it's double points. So your scores from the first 10 races that you've competed in for the week then get counted towards that medal race. And so it's a whole mathematical, strategic equation, essentially, of what your opportunities are. And so for Paris, bronze and silver were locked up. Sorry, not bronze. Gold and silver were locked up already before the medal race. And bronze was stripped at play. So anyone between 3rd and 7th had an opportunity to win bronze. So it definitely made it for an interesting race and a lot of pressure in that for that person in the bronze medal position.
Yeah, I actually watched that race yesterday just to kind of refresh on how that went. How many boats would start at the beginning of the series? Like race number 1, how many are there?
43.
43 boats. So you made it into the top 10. And in that last race, you had what I assume is a pretty good race, finishing 3rd. And that moved you up from 10th into 8th. Which, again, silver lining, you know, you finished strong, you improved your position, and you had a front row seat for your buddy winning a medal, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was very emotional. I was crying towards the end, you know, in the racing too. Like, even when I watch the race now, and when she turns back to me and starts pumping her fist, I'm already crying. So that was just a really cool moment because, you know, I might be in the boat by myself, but I'm very much part of a training group and a whole team. And she was part of my team. I've sailed with her every day for the last 3 years. So we share a lot of experience. We do all the training together. Even though she's from a different country and we're rivals or competitors on the water, we do a lot of training together, which is probably something that's unique to the sport of sailing.
Where do you do most of that training? Because she was Norwegian, right?
Yeah, I was in a European training group. So I did most of the training in Europe. We follow like a World Cup series and competitions kind of all over. So I would say primarily in Europe, sometimes in South America or Australia or something is kind of hopping on a plane and go.
So where's home base in Europe when you're training?
All over.
So there's no one training facility?
Marseille would be the place that we spent the most time because the sport of sailing, it's so important for us to spend time at these venues. Every single venue is different. Wind reacts differently on every piece of geography. Waves are different. Wind patterns are different. So we spend a lot of time learning a venue, collecting the data. And that was basically the last 2-3 years of spending as much time as we could in the summer in Marseille. And then from there, it's, you know, we have competitions in Spain. We have competition in other parts of France or Portugal. And we'll kind of go around competing.
How many of those competitions do you do in a particular year? And is there like a sailing season or is it year round depending on where the weather is?
I would say we don't really have an off season these days. Yeah, we compete. I remember the Pan Am Games was October. Our World Championships was January. And then there's competitions February, April, May. So we don't really have an off season. You kind of pick and choose what competitions you want to go to. Obviously, a World Championships or a major competition or an Olympic qualification event would be part of that. But I would say typically I'm doing about 6 competitions a year.
And they can be anywhere all over the world.
Yeah, some places are always, we have the same events. You know, we're always in Mallorca in April. We're always in France, and here is France, also in April. But like our World Championship venue, 1 year was in Holland, the next year is in Argentina.
So you mentioned you've got a support system, and I know you've got coaches, and I watched a couple of pieces about how excited you were to have your friends and family in Paris or Marseille with you. When you're sitting down to make that schedule for the year, how involved is your team in helping you make those choices? And how do you decide I'm doing this race, but not that one? And I'm going to Mallorca, but not Holland or whatever. How do you put that together?
Yeah, it's a massive process. And there's a number of people involved. I think it probably starts off with just my coach and I in establishing what our priorities are, what are our must-dos in terms of qualification events. And then we'll also bring it next to our training group and our training partners and kind of making sure we're aligning on what competitions we're doing, when everyone's going, where we want to train, and all the training blocks with that. And then once that is kind of decided on, then I'll bring it to like my larger integrated support team where we have, yeah, the mental performance coach, the nutritionist, physiologist, physiotherapist, sports doctor, strength and conditioning coach. There's a lot of people involved because it is a big program to make sure that, okay, this is the competition, say for Paris or the Olympics, I want to be peak performance here. But now you have to back up and say, okay, from a nutrition standpoint, from a strength and conditioning program, even from like sailing, you know, kind of figuring out the right formula of what it takes to create a peak performance and what are the other competitions in that year that's really important to have a peak. Because you can only really have two peak performances in a year for sailing, probably for other sports too. So there's a lot of planning and preparations in it. And it's a learning process for me as well. Like over the last 10 years, my program and the way I've set up my calendar has changed. And I learned a lot about myself and a lot about my body and, you know, when's too long to be out on the road and when's the time to come back home.
So a couple of questions out of that. What is the recovery like after you do one of these meets? Because it's a regatta, right? That's what we call it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a regatta.
I did my research a little bit. Obviously, you're doing two, sometimes three races a day, which look grueling. You're tugging on ropes and you're leaning out the side of the boat, and it looks like 45 minutes of sheer exertion. And then you maybe do it again that afternoon, and then you do it again twice the next day and twice the next day. So what are the days and weeks like afterwards while your body recovers and you catch your breath?
I think that's where, you know, planning the yearly training plan really comes into play and what the priorities are, because behind a peak performance, you're always going to need some rest. And that, you know, you're really well trained going into that competition. So I think that's probably a minimum of 2-3 weeks away from the boat. But depending on where you are and, you know, especially with this year, I don't think I had more than 17 days away from the boat. So yeah, it depends on what your priorities are and where that competition lies within the year, because some competitions are also close together within 2 weeks and you kind of just got to be like trying to recover as soon as possible. Go home if you can, rest, recuperate, and get ready for the next competition. While others, maybe you're feeling a bit more burnt out and you think, okay, it's time to just kind of rest, recuperate, and hit the gym more back at home.
So where is home when you do have a few weeks off?
Right now it's New York. Yeah, I moved here with my fiance, and that's, yeah, flight from Europe back here.
right in New York, person. In New York City?
Yeah, right in Manhattan.
Oh, very cool. But I see, again, based on the research, you're Burlington, Ontario, initially by way of Barbados, and maybe a bit of Toronto in there somewhere.
Yeah, I've been a bit all over the place. So I was born in Burlington. My parents moved up for a pretty short time where I was basically born, and my brother did a little bit of preschool. And then they said, you know what, winter's not for us, and fled back to Barbados. And that's where I spent my childhood growing up. And that's where I learned how to sail, and I absolutely loved it. And then my brother and I both came up to Canada for high school. And that's when we started competing for Canada as well. And then, I just kind of stayed in Canada and started competing for the national team.
Yeah, so I see the Ashbridges Bay Yacht Club on your resume, and I'm from Toronto, and that's just right down the street. So I was curious about that connection. You mentioned your brother. I saw some other interviews where he said he was a big influence on you, getting you into the sport. He's also an Olympian. Talk about his his impact on your career?
I mean, he's had a huge impact on our whole family. He's the one that got us into the sport. We knew nothing about sailing. We knew nothing about sports. And my brother went to summer camp. And it's funny, growing up on Barbados, he gets sent to summer camp in Canada. And that's how he realized he wanted to learn how to sail, not from being in the beautiful island of Barbados. But that's where he got exposed to sailing and wanted to learn. And so it started off as a father-son activity. And then eventually my mom and I started, and it just, yeah, blew up our whole world to now we're going around competing to, we're buying a boat, we're moving to Marina. And then, yeah, he went to 2 Olympics himself. I never had really viewed it as something that I wanted to do myself until I listened to a trampolinist, Rosie McLennan, of all sports, was one that inspired me to chase my Olympic dream. But he's very much, my brother's very much been a role model and someone that I've gone to for advice. He was there in Paris. He now works with Deloitte and does a lot of stuff in the sport business. And so he was there working for Deloitte, doing some Paris Olympic stuff. And then he came down to Marseille to cheer me on. And yeah, it's really cool to kind of have your big brother as your inspiration and always try to beat him in everything you do.
So just back that up for 1 second. Your brother was at the Olympics. You're there watching and supporting. And it didn't occur to you that someone who's doing the same sport could also do the same thing. And you had to hear Rosie McLennan talk about the Olympics before you got inspired.
Yeah, I never actually made it to, he went to Beijing and he went to London. So I think I was doing my own sailing during Beijing. And then during London, I was working, I was coaching sailing. So it's funny. I think it was maybe, I just didn't really have a female role model in sport. I don't know why. It never occurred to me that, you know, my brother did it, but I never thought I could do it myself until I heard Rosie speak. I'm not sure why.
Have you met Rosie since? Does she know that she's your inspiration?
Yeah. I think I probably pressure her a bit because I've told the story, and then it was actually pretty cool. I won my Pan Am medal, gold in Lima, and I was sharing this story with the Olympic Foundation, being like, yeah, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Rosie. It was literally, I remember the moment sitting in the crowd at this Team Ontario camp thinking, what am I doing? I want to win a gold medal. Rosie is obviously an incredible role model and so well-spoken and does a really good job of sharing the journey. And I just, yeah, I had an epiphany. And when I was sharing that story with the Olympic Foundation, they then shared it to Rosie, and I got a card from her with like a super cool, like Olympic wooden box and a sweater and a card written from her being like, I've been told, you know, I didn't realize that my speaking would have had such an impact. And I've been following you actually for a couple of years, and it's so awesome to see you. And I can't wait, hope that we're going to be teammates in Tokyo. And then I've seen her a number of events, but every time I see her, I've got like a smile on my face. I'm like, hi, Rosie. And then she was actually in Paris, part of Athlete Services. So it was just really cool that she's kind of been there and actually helped me out in some key moments. Before Tokyo Olympics, I was having a tough time and extremely burnt out. And she actually called me on the phone just trying to help out and give a helping hand. And yeah, it's really cool to kind of have your hero and someone that's inspired you to the Olympic Games kind of help you out and be there to support.
Does that make you look for younger athletes that you can kind of pay it forward, return that favor and say, hey, this kid's got potential or something like that, and really try to give them the same sort of inspiration?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I really do believe that role models play such a big role as Rosie did for me. I try to pay that forward and try to share as much as I can. And try to interact with the youth sailors or youth athletes in Canada. And yeah, maybe some of the words that I've said could play a role and hopefully inspire them to chase after their Olympic dreams or Pan Am game dreams or whatever endeavor they might want to go after.
So I'm going to go back to what I might call some dumb questions, but I'm just curious about the logistics of how some of these competitions work. So dumb question number two, I guess, is when you go to an event, do you have to bring your own boat?
99% of the time, yes. The only time that I have to, I get a supplied boat at World Championships and Olympic Games. That's it.
Okay, so the rest of the time you're going to your six World Cup events a year, you are packing and flying a boat to Mallorca.
Yeah.
Something like that. And so, go ahead, explain.
I'm fortunate. So a lot of people in teams drive their trailers and their team vans around Europe. I'm fortunate we work with a company in Sail Canada that they transport the boats for so that I can go fly and go home and rest while someone transports the boats around. And then sometimes, like for the Pan Am Games in Chile, it goes in a shipping container. Mm-hmm. So it is a massive logistical operation. So that's actually part of our yearly training plan, is just you need to get the boat certain places. So there is a whole logistical aspect of selecting which competitions you go to.
So along the same lines, you mentioned Sail Canada. You're obviously getting support from them. You're probably getting some support from sponsors. I notice you're RBC Olympian. Trying to, are you also sailing for a club or your training group? Are they affiliated somehow? So how do you balance kind of who does what?
In terms of support and funding?
Or just even just kind of managing your season. Who gets priority? Is this a Team Canada event or is this a Sarah Douglas, CEO of, I think you said Sarah Douglas Incorporated? yeah. So when are you racing for you? When are you racing for Canada? When are you racing for your club or your training partners? And just managing that whole ecosystem.
Yeah, just I guess to simplify it is that we're always representing Canada. We don't really have like club teams or club programs. We represent different yacht clubs. So I'm a member of actually three different yacht clubs. And we'll kind of like put their burgees different places. But I'm basically almost always representing Sail Canada and Team Canada at all these events. Now, depending on which kind of competition it is, obviously the Olympic Games or Pan Am Games, you're part of Team Canada and the Olympic Committee, and they organize those aspects and logistics. While World Cup, I'm basically on my own representing Canada. I do all my own logistics. I book all my flights, Airbnbs, buy the food, cook the food. I'm in charge, and that's where the CEO of Sarah Douglas Sailing comes in.
So just, you don't have to get too deep into it, but just the funding, this sounds like it's a very expensive endeavor. By the time you're traveling the world and, you know, I know from every other sport, there's hotels, there's food, there's your team, whether it's your coaches, your physio, your mental performance, all of these people that may or may not be with you at certain times. It's expensive to fly teams around the world. So how are you managing that? I know you get some funding from various places, but if you want to elaborate a little bit, go ahead.
Yeah, I basically have to figure out how to distribute the funds and how I want to use it. I'm in charge, for the most part, of how the money gets spent. There is a massive fundraising effort that comes from me and the various yacht clubs that I'm part of. You know, the money that we get from Sport Canada and the money that we get from Sail Canada just simply isn't enough. We need to seek out other sources of funding to support our, you know, yearly training program and competition schedule. So I've had multiple fundraisers. I've received grants from the Olympic Foundation to Corinthian funds at different yacht clubs. And I've had an amazing group of different donors who continue to support me. And I've had help from Astros Bay Yacht Club. They have like a fundraising committee to kind of help, you know, relieve some of that stress, because I would say probably before this year, it has been the number one stress of competing in the Olympic Games, is trying to figure out how to fund and source all the funding to compete at the top level.
And I think that's kind of a running theme for a lot of dare I say, the fringe sports, where if you're not basketball or hockey or, you know, one of those main main programs, there is funding, but it all gets run through a federation or an association, and then it all gets distributed on how they see fit, and they might be trying to support a dozen or 20 different athletes, and so you're only getting a small piece of that pie along the way. So I do think that is a running theme, and that's not a not a complaint to the committee. I don't know if there's a better way to do it, but it is something that kind of does seem to be an issue for a lot of these, again, the less famous sports.
Yeah, and less famous, and maybe the ones that also don't produce as many Olympic medals. I feel like, you know, yeah, swimming and cycling, they're all taken care of. They get their flights booked for them. They get told which competitions or, you know, what hotel they're staying at. While, you know, sailing, we haven't had an Olympic medal since 2004. So I understand why, you know, why we might not get the same support, and we're also not, you know, on the TV as much as a swimming or a track athlete would be. But one of the questions is always, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? And, you know, we do need the funding, and that's where we seek out donors. And it's such, especially for the sport of sailing and maybe other sports that are smaller, it takes such a community, takes a village to get an athlete or a team to an Olympic Games. And that's where, when I look back at the last 10 years, I've had an amazing village, you know, supporting me and getting me to where I've gotten to today.
So you already mentioned some of them, but I want to give you a chance to, like, shout out to all the people who got you there, because, you know, obviously you keep referring to this village or this team or this enterprise that is your athletic career. So who needs thanks, and who do you want to shout out, whether it's family or coaches or sponsors or whoever? Take a couple of minutes and just recognize them.
Oh man, the list can go on and on. I mean, yeah, obviously the parents, you know, they're incredible in support. I'm a member of three different yacht clubs, Astridge's Bay, New York Yacht Club, and Royal Canadian Yacht Club. Those have been instrumental in supporting and getting athletes to the Olympic Games as well. My sponsors, yeah, RBC and USANA. I have an amazing, like, partnership and team with the Canadian Sport Institute of Ontario, Sail Canada. Yeah, my sailing coach, Vaughn Harrison. I mean, there's just endless people to thank. And the Olympic Foundation has been so supportive and really helped me out with a number of grants as well. Even the Murphy Family Foundation and Olympian Sporting Olympians. And yeah, the list can go on. And it really does surprise me. And I'm just in awe of the support that will come towards an Olympic Games. And it's so cool how sport can bring a whole community together.
It's very cool. So, speaking of Olympics games, is there another one in your future?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure yet. I'm still recovering from Paris. Yeah, it's been about a month and a half, and I'm still recuperating. You know, it was a really long, basically 10 years. So I'm not sure yet. I do have to get a hip surgery and figure that out, but I'm not sure at the moment.
I was going to ask, because of the physical strain on your body, I was trying to figure out what part gets hurt the most among sailors. And I figured it was quads and hips, or maybe just ab tears or something, because you're doing so many full strength, lean back kind of sit up positions that must put a lot of strain on those parts of the body. Is that right?
Yeah, hips, ankles, lower back is a big one. So yeah, I put a little too much, I think, on my hips, and now I'm looking into a surgery in February, and that's like a 6-month recovery. And so I'll kind of take that time to figure out what's next. I don't want to just do an Olympic Games to do an Olympic Games. I really do think your heart has to be in it, and you have to be fully enjoying the process. And that's what I'm going to use the next year to figure out, do some other sailing, and start figuring out my wedding for next year. And then, yeah, when it comes to next summer, be like, you know what, do I really want, is my heart in it? I do believe I have the ability to win an Olympic medal still. I've been pretty close the last two times, and Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, two Olympics, a sixth and an eighth, top 10 in the world, I'd say, can you say fairly consistently? That's got to put you in a mix,
yeah,
in that mindset of, hey, I can do this. I'm not far off. So what, if not for you specifically, what does Sail Canada need to do? What's the next step to get that little last bit of progress up to the podium?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sail Canada is in a bit of a transition moment now in terms of leadership. We've just lost our high performance director and we've just brought on a new CEO. So we're in a bit of a transition. So I'm not fully sure what's the direction or what's going to happen there. In terms of Sarah Douglas Sailing, you know, I think a couple things need to switch up within the team. And I mean, LA is certainly tempting, and that is an amazing venue for sailing. I've been there a couple times. Being in North America, I think it would just be an amazing Olympic Games experience, and the training there would be amazing. So I think I definitely know in terms of the specific techniques and the elements of my sailing that needs to continue to improve. But it's a massive endeavor and a massive foundational piece in terms of support as well that would need to, I'll be there as well.
Yeah. And like you said, you've got some other stuff to worry about between now and then. Surgery, obviously a big one, your wedding. People forget that athletes have lives too. You know, they've got to deal with all the day-to-day things on top of trying to be a world-class athlete.
Yeah, I've missed a lot of weddings in my days and a lot of events. And, you know, I've just been on the road pretty much nonstop for the last couple of years. So I'm excited that, yeah, my time is finally here. I'm in my bridal era. It's good to kind of, yeah, I've been engaged for a year and a half and we've kind of pushed things back for Paris. So it's going to be great to get married and be part of that experience.
Is your fiance a sailor too?
He is.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just does for like a hobby, like a rec, but we actually met sailing as kids.
Very cool. So I just got along the same lines in preparation for this. I was reading your Wikipedia and I kind of poked through your Instagram for a bit. And you just went out for a run for fun. And I thought that was like, oh, that must be a nice relaxing feeling where you're not on the clock. You said you weren't counting your heartbeats or anything. What's it like to kind of have that freedom and allow yourself to decompress for a little bit?
It's been so good just to try different workouts. Yeah, I've been following a gym program for the last 10 years where every day, you know, you look at the app, you see what your scheduled workout is. You don't really have that much of a choice. You wear a Garmin and a heart rate strap and you're so cognizant of what your heart rate is during this like hour long zone 2 bike. So going out for a run just because I wanted to, not having any sort of tracking or plan or specific workout, just being like, you know what, I'm just gonna run. That was like the fastest 25 minutes of my life. Like my fiance was like, okay, like we have to go back, I have something for work, and I was like, oh, that was such a quick run. So it's been really cool to just really enjoy fitness and not kind of feel like it's a chore. I've been trying all sorts of different workouts and cycle classes and berries to solid core and all these different types of workouts with like amazing music and group classes, which I never did a group class, and it was such specific training. So I'm really enjoying that right now.
That's cool. So I'm just going to stick with the Instagram things. Other things I picked out from your Instagram. One, I know it got a lot of attention during the games, but just your pastry quests and your rankings of all the different muffins and croissants and all that stuff. I enjoyed it. I found it a little bit, I love it because I mean, I who doesn't love a croissant, but how much did you have to balance when you were eating certain things, or were you burning so many calories you could eat whatever you want?
Well, it was all post competition.
Okay.
So at that point, that was my diet. I was on croissants for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
And did you have a favorite?
I loved the chocolate muffin. Yeah, I thought I was going to love the cookie croissant more, but the chocolate muffin was just like a rich, like fudgy chocolate muffin. And I understand why it was viral.
Yeah, that one definitely went viral. You see, there was a, I think this is one Norwegian guy who was eating 10 of them a day or something because he thought they were so fantastic. Yeah, the cookie croissant did look very good, though.
It was really good. My teammate, Justin, preferred that over the muffin. Yeah, he loved it. It was very good. Like, I definitely would have it again.
And the last thing from Instagram is you made me very jealous by playing golf at Cabot in Nova Scotia lately.
It was amazing.
Are you a big golfer?
I'm becoming one. Yeah, I learned during COVID, and my fiance plays a lot for work and just like recreationally. So I was very excited to have like my first golf trip at like the top place. I mean, Cabot was incredible. It was great weather. It was my first time walking a course, actually. So I was a bit worried because I've done most of my golfing in Florida or where it's a golf cart. And so I just had the best time in Cabot. You know, we stayed on property at those villas, and yeah, it was definitely a top tier experience and definitely makes me want to golf more. So I've got a couple more golf trips in mind and definitely going to bring the golf clubs around more now that I don't have to like schlep sailing gear everywhere.
Yeah, Cabot's definitely on my bucket list. I haven't done it yet. I've done the Scotland trip, so checked off a lot of those boxes, but Cabot, especially, I mean, I live in Canada. You think I could get there a little bit easier than Scotland, but haven't done it yet. It just looks absolutely fantastic, so I'm hoping to get there someday.
Yeah, I should.
Yeah, I plan to. Are you a good golfer?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I'm still in the phase of not really counting. Like, I think I have amazing moments, and I had a lesson actually at Cabot and kind of changed my swing, which is good. But I mean, I don't know. Is anyone really a good golfer? I mean, they all have meltdowns. They all slice the ball but I think with Cabot, I just had so much fun. I didn't really care. But I couldn't tell you what my score is.
No, I think that's healthy because I think a lot of people who A, aren't good enough or B, try too hard, they're not going to enjoy the game. And so if you can, you know, kind of forget what the number is and you just go enjoy the walk, that's a pretty good way to think about it. I'm certainly not a good golfer, so I'm a very average, moments of brilliance. Like you said, a couple of meltdowns mixed in, but you can get a bit of everything when you golf with me. Yeah, so I just we'll wrap it up shortly. I just want to know, like, so you said you've got surgery coming, you've got a wedding coming, so you're not really entirely sure what the next year or two holds from a competitive standpoint. When do you plan on sailing again? Maybe is the question.
A laser? Yeah, I'm not sure when I'll sail the laser, the Ilka again. I think I'll be out of that boat probably for a year. I will do some kind of recreational sailing, and my fiance does some like bigger boat sailing for fun. So I might hop in on that a bit this winter in Florida. And then, yeah, go from there and see what the opportunities are. And I mean, I get the surgery in February and I'll be like learning how to walk and figure it all out again. So that'll put me out until I think it's like August and see. So I don't have plans at the moment. It's just kind of see and golf in the meantime.
And plan a wedding.
And plan a wedding. Yeah, that's the invites actually just went out today. So we got a lot on.
Where's that wedding going to happen?
It's in Toronto.
In Toronto. At the RCYC?
No, we're not going to get married there. We will have an event in a regatta. But no, well, that's kind of like my place of work half the time. So
don't want to get married at work. That makes sense. No, I only ask because I've been to a wedding at the Royal Canadian Yacht Club.
It's a beautiful venue. It's
out on the island. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's got a stunning view of the city. It is one of my favorite places to go. It's a beautiful spot.
So, like, last question is, what is something maybe that we didn't quite get into or just something that people don't know about sailing or competitive sailing or the deep, dark underside that doesn't get talked about. One thing that came to mind, I'll give you a little.
Yeah, no.
The one that I'm wondering about is how much bumper boats happen. Like, you know, because you get a fleet of 10 boats fighting over the same wind. How often are they smashing into each other?
Yeah, we try to avoid smashing because they're all made out of fiberglass, and that causes boat work. And laser sailors are like infamous for not doing boat work, don't enjoying doing that. So I think probably something that people don't realize with that is, to reduce the bumper boats, we have a whole massive set of rules. We have a massive rule book that you study as a kid. Like when you learn to race, you need to like study this thing. And sometimes someone will break a rule, whether it's boat on boat or rounding a mark or something. And we have, you can protest someone. And then we have, after getting onto the land, we have like basically like a jury set up. So you present your case, you have a witness, you present to the jury. There's like a panel of people, of international jurors. And you present it, they present their case, and it's a whole massive, paperwork presentation that I don't think is really practiced enough, because we try to avoid the protest room if you can, but it is a big part of our sport. And we even have like a jury group back in Canada on call in case there is a rule break and we need help with just presenting our case. That's probably it. Unexpected thing with the sport of sailing.
Yeah, that's a deep cut that I would not have thought about. But you did remind me, sorry, I do have one more question of, you mentioned the protest flag, and that triggered a memory of watching a different Instagram of you unpacking your wet gear a month after the Olympics.
I know. Disgusting.
How did it take so long? Tell me just a little bit about that, because, and also, you know, the only reason I ask is the protest flag was still on the vest, right?
Yeah, it was still attached to the life jacket. Yeah, I travel a lot of stuff. I had 3 suitcases plus the Yeti backpack full of gear, and I had dealt with the first 2. And when I got back from the Olympics, I had a wedding within a couple of days, so I was only home for a handful of days. Went to the wedding, went home for a couple of days, went on a golf trip, went home for a couple of days. Like I was just kind of all over the place. So I just left it and be like, well, I don't need these things right now. And then it dawned on me last week, like, oh no, my sailing gear has been sitting in there for like a month, just untouched. So yeah, it was still wet. There was no mold. I didn't quite see that. But I did put it through the washing machine about 2-3 times.
It must have had quite an aroma. A little musty?
It wasn't too bad. No, it wasn't. It wasn't too bad. I thought it was going to be worse. I honestly think like people's shoes smell bad, like worse than my sailing gear.
Well, there you have it. You can leave your wet gear in a bag for a month and it won't be as bad as
your
shoes.
I would not recommend it.
Okay. Well, again, I'm going to say thank you one more time for taking the time. I've really enjoyed this. It's been fantastic. I've learned a lot. I wish you the best, whatever the future holds, whether, hope the surgery goes well, hope the wedding goes well, and we'll see what sort of competition, if any, emerges after that.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian. It's been a great convo on it. Trust me, no dumb questions in the sport of sailing. Those were no stupid questions.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I'm not as dumb as I look is what I'm taking from that. All right, well, thank you so much, and all the best moving forward. See Thee Rise is a Left Button production. Follow us on Instagram at See Thee Rise Pod or email us at seetherisepodcast@gmail.com.